Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. Diversity and inclusion have long been recognized as critical in higher education. And within the past decade, many K-12 schools have also increased their focus in these areas, acknowledging the reality that today's students live in a diverse world. Students' individual backgrounds each come with unique needs and challenges, and educators are working to help them prepare to enter a diverse society and workforce, where they'll most certainly meet people of many different races, religions, sexualities, and perspectives. School administrators are seeking the best possible ways to handle conflict, foster an inclusive educational environment, and better prepare students for the diverse world in which they live, overcoming barriers to student success. But how should these sensitive topics be taught, and who should have a say? Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seewert. Diversity, equity, and inclusion training has gained momentum over the years, but recent debates over curriculum choices have administrators working to balance the needs of students and seek greater transparency as they approach delicate subjects like race, gender, sexuality, and more, despite the deep divides in public opinion. Today, we'll hear about the ways local educators are tackling this issue in the K-12 setting. Throughout the program, we invite you to join the conversation and ask your own questions by calling us at 800-780-9742 or email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Sam Dinga is the former director of diversity and college access at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. He also spent more than 4 years as mentoring and internship coordinator at the school. Now he's the equity, diversity, and inclusion coordinator for the Stevens Point Area Public School District, where he is working to foster a healthy environment for all students while keeping the needs of parents and educators close at hand. Sam, welcome to Route 51.
Thank you for having me.
Melanie Leverson is a nationally certified school psychologist and licensed director of special education and pupil services. She's been working in and supporting schools for nearly 20 years. Currently, Melanie is employed as an educational consultant for Systems Equity as part of the new Collaborative Organization Revitalization for Equity, or CORE, service at CESA 10. In Wisconsin, each CESA, or Cooperative Educational Services Agency, acts as a link between school districts and between individual districts and the state. CESA 10 serves school districts in West Central Wisconsin. Melanie, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Sam, what does equity, diversity, and inclusion mean to you?
Well, to me, diversity means different people, different things, different, and being together. Inclusion is making sure every person is included in what's going on. And equity is providing people what they need based on their needs. And so that is how I approach that. That is how I do my job from those definitions.
And Melanie, I'd like to ask you the same thing. When you hear those words, equity, diversity, inclusion, what does that mean to you?
I think with my background in schools, it's especially pertinent for me with students. That's what I think about the most. So I think about the diversity of our students, whether that's socioeconomic status or race or ethnicity. And like Sam said, the differences that they bring to the table. And I think inclusion for me highlights the idea that every one of those students should feel included, should feel valued at school, and that the differences that they bring to the table often are strengths that if we can recognize them as a school, we can build upon. And equity, very similar, just that people are getting what they need when they need it. It's not all about giving everyone the exact same. It's not about being equal. It's really about trying to find a fair way to support the people around us.
In the national conversation about these subjects, one word seems to be the one that people center on, and it's equity when it comes to the controversy surrounding this. Why is the word equity one that evokes such emotion with people? What's the story there, Sam?
You know, it is difficult to pinpoint where equity became that challenging word in a way. But I think part of the issue is the misunderstanding of what equity is. Remember, some people define it, and in the process of doing that, they talk about equality, but that is not what equity is. A couple of weeks ago, I was talking to a friend of mine who owned different types of dogs. And I said, you don't own all German Shepherds. You own different types of dogs. These are different. That is diversity within your different dogs that you own. Two of the dogs had challenges. One had a broken limb. Another one had issues with the eyesight. And I said, in the process of play, you provide a wheel to the dog without with a painful limb. And you had a ball with a bell whistle to help the dog without a good eyesight to know where the ball is. That's equity. You're providing equity to make sure all those dogs are included during playtime. That is exactly what this is, right? We're making sure that because all the students in the school, in our school district, we have about 6,990 students. 21% of those students are from different ethnic background, different races, different, they probably speak, they all speak different languages on top of English, right? But these students come with different needs when it comes to how they learn because of their different backgrounds. They have different needs economically because of their economic backgrounds. And so to provide and make sure these students are safe, they're learning, they're growing, they're being kids in whatever grades they are, we have to pay attention to equity, because providing a flat line of equality for everyone doesn't help everyone, because some might not need have the need, some might need certain things more than others. So we hope that that definition of what equity is and the difference between equity and inclusion is clear. We try to do that through publications, through speaking and radio and community organization. We try to make that message clear about the differences between equality and equity.
Melanie, did you want to build on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that part of the controversy that we frequently hear about in our work is this idea that equity means that one group has to give something up in order for another group to get what they need. And what we see and what we work on with schools is not at all that. It's really about being aware of the distinct needs of each student or of each person that you're working with and finding ways to meet those needs. And like Sam said so eloquently, not everybody needs the same thing. And also, when we're trying to be equitable, when we're trying to make sure people get what they need, it doesn't mean that we're taking from one group and giving to another. And I think that's part of the controversy that people feel about the word.
I want to ask right off the bat, there's been a lot of talk in Wisconsin and nationally about critical race theory. Are these programs, Sam, the same as critical race theory?
No. And I think, again, that is where some of those misunderstanding is coming. It's understanding what those definitions are and people not knowing what the definition of CTR, critical race theory, is. It's easy for people to misunderstand, misconstrue, or misrepresent what school districts are doing. Critical race theory is not taught in any school, K-12, let alone even in college, in high schools and colleges. I have not seen it. I have not been a part of it. The school district I work for, I know for a fact that is not part of the curriculum.
So, Melanie, you're involved in this new collaborative organization, Revitalization for Equity, the core service at CESA 10. Explain what that is and how did it all come together?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a long story, so I'll try to be brief. I started out my career as a school psychologist and worked in a school district that was identified as disproportionate in our special education data. So we were over-identifying certain students, specifically Black students, in emotional behavioral disability programming. And as part of the corrective action plan, we started installing some systems to support behavior. So practices that everyone would use, that we were teaching specifically how we wanted students to behave and then holding them accountable for those behaviors, whether that was letting them know they got it right or giving them more teaching when they didn't get it right. Through that, we started thinking about how normal behavior is defined and how sometimes normal behavior in one household is not the same as normal behavior in another household. That definition, that idea of normal, is actually very variable. And that's how I got into the work of cultural responsiveness or equity. We started thinking about how to make sure those systems were actually reflective of the communities and the students that they were serving, because there are some behaviors in schools, obviously, that are wrong, just absolutely wrong. We do not want them. But there's some variation in many behaviors for what is normal or expected. And some of that variation needs to be taught to students. So that's how I came to the work. And recently moving to CISA 10, what we were finding is that systems need to think about equity and sort of that definition of normal outside of behavior as well. So thinking about whether or not policies are set up for everyone in a system to be successful, whether that's a school or a district or child protective services agencies. So what we wanted to do was broaden the scope of our work beyond education to make sure that any system that wanted to think about whether or not their outcomes were working for everyone they're serving could come to us and work through some of the steps that we've identified.
So, Sam, you work to promote diversity and inclusion at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. Now you're in a K-12 role. What's different about the efforts when it comes to the K-12 setting compared to the efforts at the university level? What's the difference between those two?
For me, the biggest difference is at the university, you're providing the services directly to the students, and they are, for the most part, adults who make the decision to consume or be a part of what you're doing. Whereas in the K-12, these are minors, which means you have to inform parents about what you're doing, when you'll be doing it, how you'll be doing it, and in most cases, provide the opportunity for parents to opt out, right? And in some cases, you have to seek board approval to execute certain programs or introduce new curriculum. And so that is a big difference. It takes time to prep and send out the information. Part of the challenge with that is sometimes the information is pushed out by whoever in the district. It could be pushed out before you edit, audit, and get all the necessary approvals. And the general public might end up consuming the making of that sausage, so to speak, you know, before it is finally made. And that is a very dangerous position to be. So those are challenges that we face in the process of trying to get all the approvals and send out the emails and give parents the opportunity to opt in or out in some cases. But I think it gives that transparency and gives that authority for parents to know what's happening and give them a chance to be a part of what we are doing. I believe, having four kids in the school district, that I believe that teachers and administrators, they come to work every day with the intention of being the best, putting out their best. And in the process of that, they do make mistakes, like every human being in every position we hold. But that is not to say it's any ill intention. But like I said, the big difference in college is you're dealing directly with adults, and in the K-12, you're dealing with minors and working with parents and board members.
You're listening to Sam Dinga and Melanie Leverson on Route 51 as we continue our discussion on K-12 diversity and inclusion initiatives in the face of continuing debate over such programs and the equity movement overall. Coming up, we'll hear about how local educators are involving parents in the decision-making process, and we'll answer your questions, too, when you call us at 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Melanie Leverson and Sam Dinga are with us today as we continue our conversation about equity, diversity, and inclusion programs in the K-12 setting. What would you like to know? You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone. The number to call is 800-780-9742. Melanie, take me through the process. How do you decide what a district needs? Do you start with a needs assessment? What happens?
Yes, absolutely. So generally, districts come to us with one or two questions in mind, whether that's something that's concerning at the school board level or in the community. or just something that someone in a leadership role wants to do better at, that's generally where they start with us. So they'll come to us thinking, one of our districts specifically wants to talk about their policies and whether or not their board policies for students and educators are equitable. Are they meeting the needs of everyone that they're supposed to meet? And also, are they a match for what's actually happening in the school? So that's a conversation that they wanted to have. When they came to us with that, I think one of the things that they were hoping for was maybe a checklist, just to put each policy next to a checklist and go through and see if they were equitable. And through conversations, we were able to talk through the idea that there really need to be more voices at the table in order to determine that. It can't happen just through a checklist. So we have coached them through looking at their data. They've been pulling multiple sources of data. I think that through that, they're recognizing that maybe there's some data that they don't have quick, efficient access to. Some of the things like how many times students are leaving the classroom to go to the nurse's office, for example, that's sometimes data that schools aren't collecting, but it's a really good sign of how well students feel like they fit in a system. So we're looking through their data. We're also encouraging them specifically to build a team, not just of educators from the system, but of community members that are invested in the work. So we want to be sure that the community voice, the family voice on that team is the heaviest voice, and that we're facilitating conversations about how community and family members are feeling about these policies as well. That's some of the work that we're doing.
Sam, what was the first thing that you did when you were appointed to this position in Stevens Point? How did you decide which path to take for the district?
An interesting question. I had a series of meetings with the leadership that I was going to work with. And during my interview, I shared with them, I'm a big picture kind of person, and I'm looking at this position, what it could be, you know, what it could do, the direction that I would like to go within the next 5 to 10 years. And one of the things that I identified was how we could get the teachers that we work with to be a part of this, to support this. And so we had a series of meetings with teachers, and we quickly learned that they want to know that they'll be fully supported by the leadership, the board, the cabinet. We came up with, let's work and come up with a statement, a commitment statement that says, we are behind you. And we worked with the teachers to draft this statement, work with, we got student input, got other staff members' input, shared with cabinet, and we're working our way through to get a board approval with this statement that is saying everybody's in this, we're in this together, that leadership will support the work that we are doing. The second step was I realized that for this work to succeed, we have to get the community engaged. And so for this to happen, I am creating what I'm calling the Alliance for Equity and Inclusion. And this has to do, it includes community members, parents, teachers, staff, students. We're launching this April 6th. And the goal for this is to have everybody come together. We might not agree on everything, but we can learn together and grow together, identify needs and find solutions together. There's going to be a series of support groups for parents, you know, through this alliance. An example for such group would be, say, parents with biracial kids, right? They have similar challenges. So the hope is to bring these parents together. They can share their challenges and share resources and share their needs. And that way they can channel what they think they need as a group to cabinet and eventually board. Or parents with LGBTQ plus students, what are their challenges? What are their needs? And so those group of parents can get together and share what they're feeling, what they're seeing, and the things that they're hearing from their students. And they can channel, again, their issues to the cabinet that way or eventually to the board. So those are things that I started drafting from day one and almost getting to the point where we're launching April 6th. I'm really excited about this. And then one of the things that this alliance will be doing also is creating avenues and opportunities for us to have open conversation with the community, invite guest speakers, create panels, and discuss some of these very difficult topics, the challenging issues and misconceptions, and help with definitions and sometimes what I'm beginning to see is sometimes it's us parents being afraid to all not wanting to open up and learn these things. The kids are learning them. They're knowing about them. They're hearing them. They have TikTok. They have YouTube and everything. If we're not part of this conversation, our kids, they're several steps ahead of us, right? How many times as a parent have you called your kid to come and navigate your iPhone? And
right.
They don't have that, but they're the ones helping you navigate those things. So when it comes to a lot of these topics, they are ahead of us as parents. So we seem to be, understandably so, we are cautious as parents, but our kids, really, they are ahead of the game. I was sharing, I was having a conversation with my daughter, and it got to a point I'm trying to explain, and she said, name it, right? She's saying, name it, say the word. I know what it is. And she's seven. Mm-hmm. So we are at a place where we have to create opportunities for us as a community to learn and be a part of the conversation, be a part of the solution, whatever the issue might be. And so I'm looking forward to this alliance being an opportunity to get the community activated, community engaged, and get parents and teachers being a part of this with us together, being part of this work that we're doing. So it has been an exciting ride since I started.
That's really interesting. Melania, I have to wonder your thoughts on this. Who do you think should lead those conversations that Sam was talking about? Those conversations about family values and controversial topics, should parents or children lead them? How do you balance that?
I think that's a great question. Honestly, I think there has to be a balance there of both. One of the things that I think is contributing to what Sam is describing is that we are facing a generation of adults right now that were largely taught that being colorblind was the way to be about race, that we were not supposed to talk about race, that everyone's the same on the inside, and that the polite thing to do was not say anything about someone's skin color. And I don't know that at the time, I don't think that that was malicious. I don't think that anyone was trying to do anything wrong. However, we're at a point in time where when we don't acknowledge race, we're erasing the history of people, many people who are especially not white, because those are the stories that are frequently not told in our history books. And I think what Sam is describing is we have children coming up in a society that's more diverse than it ever has been, especially in our nation. And especially given us growing, like us adults now having grown up, and they're more prepared for these conversations in many ways than we as adults are. So I think in some places, in some spaces, we need to, as adults, be a little bit willing to be uncomfortable and help our children lead us in these conversations. That doesn't mean I think that we should just defer to our kids all the time. I have a couple and I would say no thank you to that.
Sure.
But they definitely have experiences that I think can lend value to these conversations and help us as adults grow and just be better humans.
Not everyone is on board with these kinds of programs. Obviously, the group Parents Defending Education, for example, this organization, very critical of diversity and inclusion policies. On its website, the group identifies one of its goals as fighting, quote, indoctrination in the classroom. Sam, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I am excited that people are engaged, right? And they might not be engaged in the direction that I wish they were, but that is not for me to say. I am, however, excited that they are engaged in what is happening and very active about that. The dangers, though, is teachers are trained professionals to teach students, and they're doing child pedagogy and whatever classes they're taking. They are the professionals to do this. I think in the process of being engaged and being excited to be a part of it, I continue to encourage folks to not stand in the way for the teachers to do the jobs they're supposed to do. Again, I've said it, we would make mistakes as school district and administrators and teachers. It is not an intended plan. We sit down and say, how can we mess the lives of these kids that are entrusted to us? When we make those mistakes, we continue to encourage parents to meet with us and community members. I've sat in a series of meetings with parents who are upset for one thing or the other, but the goal at those meetings is to get an understanding of what happened, what should be happening, what make sure it doesn't happen again in some cases, or make sure we come to an understanding, create policies, policies and practices, and create a plan moving forward. So again, I'm excited that folks are engaged in this, what is happening in schools, but I hope that we all approach this with one goal, to educate our kids, make our communities better, make our communities inclusive, and be aware that we are different. Melanie was talking about in the old days when they talked about colorblind. I've been in classes when I was a student at UWSB, and students would say, I was taught to be colorblind. At the time, it didn't really matter to me at the time, but I've come to know that if you don't see color, you can't see pattern, right? If I'm telling you the challenges and lived experiences, and because you don't want to see color, either you were trained to not see color or you're choosing to not see color, then you cannot understand my lived experiences as a Black man in Central Wisconsin in a predominantly white, who went to a predominantly white institution, working in a predominantly, white organization right now. There are challenges that I have as a person of color. And you have to see my color to identify that. And students who are from the LGBTQ plus background or economically disadvantaged background or whatever the difference is, or one minority group define themselves, you have to see that. You have to identify that so you can identify the challenges that comes with being a part of that group to be able to address them. If you see everybody as one, as the same, then you think everybody's challenges are the same. Then you miss the point of why we need equity. We need equity because we need different things. Within our household, when families go out to eat, there might be one family member who need a booster seat, right? That is because they're younger, they need a booster seat. Them having a booster seat don't stop me from having the chair that I will be having, right? In some restaurants, they'll give another family member a taller seat because they cannot sit down in the lower seat. So all those differences happens the same in the school district. Again, I'm happy folks are engaged, but they should understand that these folks are the professionals trained to do this job. I don't go to, again, let me take this opportunity and share. When I came from Africa and visited a doctor's hospital for the first time, and the doctor asked me, what do you think? I was like, whoa. I've never had a doctor ask me what I was thinking, and they're asking me my treatment plan. I cannot understand that. But now I get it. They're bringing me along. They're making me part of the plan. We are doing the same thing in the school district. We're asking, we're sharing with parents. We attend PTOs. We are creating this support group and bringing parents and community members, like all of us together. But acknowledging and identifying that teachers continue to be the trained professionals to do the work, the strategies to get the kids engaged and involved and informed. But I continue to want everybody to be involved in what we're doing. Otherwise, we would stay ignored. So I don't want to be ignored. I want them to be part of what we're doing.
Melanie, one of the big questions is who gets to decide. How much input should parents have when it comes to the curriculum offered in public schools? Sam talked a little bit earlier about the importance of bringing families into it, bringing parents into it. How much input do they need to have?
That's such an interesting question. And even this concept of indoctrination is so interesting to me, because there isn't a curriculum out there that's being imposed upon schools or that schools are adopting that's equity, diversity, and inclusion, that's teaching students specifically to believe one political belief or lean towards side. So I think that's a misconception that's out there. But when you ask about how much families and parents should have about the curriculum, I think one thing to lean on is how our school boards are set up in Wisconsin. Our school boards are elected officials. Their job as elected officials is to oversee the work of the superintendent. So even at a school board level, those people are not tasked with micromanaging and determining what's in the curriculum. They're tasked with making sure that the superintendent is staying true to the district's strategic goals and plans and their vision and mission for the future. And that's something that's decided somewhat at a board level. So when we think about families and communities being involved in curricular decisions, I am wholeheartedly a proponent of the it takes a village to raise a child theory. I think that families and communities have to be involved in our schools, and they have a right to be involved in our schools. They're publicly funded. They're established specifically for students in a geographical region. Those students are the only people that have a right to be in those doors every single day. And also, we have to trust some of the professionals that we are hiring and that our school boards are monitoring and supporting to make really solid decisions that align with our district's mission and vision that's driven by elected officials in our communities. So while I think that could sound a little bit harsh, I also know that in the school districts I've worked with, which has been quite a few over the past 10 years, there is no adopted curriculum that's trying to indoctrinate students to believe a certain thing. When we talk about equity, even if I meet someone who is very politically diverse from my own opinion, we can always come together on the fact that we want children to do well and to feel like they belong in school. And that's really the core of our work. We want children to do well. We want school to work for them. We want them to feel like they belong there.
Sam, you talked a little bit earlier about the different needs of people, seeing the different needs of people. But what happens when needs conflict with one another? For example, a female Muslim student's religious needs versus the needs of transgender students when it comes to locker rooms and bathrooms. How do you manage and balance those?
That's another very good question. And we're seeing some of those things. Good thing is the school district has been ahead of some of those issues. For example, when I came in, we did an audit on the bathrooms to see what kind of bathrooms we have, where do we have those bathrooms, not just for gender issues, but for security reasons, right? We want to make sure students feel safe when they go to the bathrooms and so forth. So in the process, I realized that the Stevens Point Area School District has been ahead of this game and, you know, paying attention to the bathrooms and making sure that students have bathrooms, safe bathrooms, and places that they can use when they need to. Again, when these conflicts occur, we have different sections or committees that sit to address some of these things. We have safety committees that are looking at these things. Again, even as to force the desegregation of those data, somebody has to pay attention to who falls in that 5%. Somebody has to be intentional about what to do to make sure that we close that gap. That is where our role comes to play in making sure that the 5%, they feel included, they feel safe.
These are emotional issues. There are strong feelings all around. Melanie, what kind of data do you use? What kind of research are you relying on that's shaping the programs that you're proposing in the schools while keeping the kind of political and emotional arguments out of the equation?
Well, some of the data that we're asking schools specifically to look at are things like what Sam is talking about. So engagement surveys, school climate surveys. We want to know how students are feeling in schools. We're having schools look at things like their youth risk behavior surveys, YRBS. That's something that all schools in Wisconsin are taking. So having them think through who their students are, who are not connected, who don't feel like they have a staff member they can go to, who are maybe doing some risky behaviors. That's all data that we're hoping that our schools are looking at and relying on. We're also encouraging schools to look at systemic data. So are you doing what you said you would do? Do you have meetings to talk about how things are going? Are you frequently sharing data with staff? Things like that are all really critical. And then the basis of our work out in the public realm, a lot of it lies in some conversations about implicit bias. So the Harvard Implicit Association Test is one that's been around for a long time, and there's a great deal of research that's come out around that in thinking about how we all collectively, everyone in society has biases that we are not aware of that may not reflect our beliefs and what we value, but may influence our behaviors. So that's a big conversation that we have and lean on. And we also lean on a lot of the work that is available through multi-level systems of support in schools, which is based on a public health model, actually, thinking through what everybody needs to be provided universally, whether that's behavior instruction or academic instruction, and then how to build systems so that if that instruction universally doesn't work, we can layer on supports for students in an effective and efficient way. So that's where a great deal of our research is coming from at the moment.
Sam, I'm curious, what have been the biggest challenges so far that you've faced in this role as you work on in this program? What's been the most difficult thing to overcome?
I don't think I can say difficult things to overcome, because we're working towards a lot of the challenges that we face. Part of it, coming into a structure that there were people already doing some of this work loosely in different areas and trying to create unity and kind of unify the players, make sure we can, you know, create a roadmap moving forward. So there's challenges while we're building those things, for example, designing and recruiting, and we'll be training members of this alliance. There are issues that are popping up in different areas. And so we would get there someday. We already talked about the politics surrounding the work, people having different definition of what my role is, not actually knowing that is a big hurdle. And I hope the more we get out doing programs like this, people understand the work we're doing. So I'm optimistic that we will get to a point where some of the challenges that I'm facing right now would no longer be challenges, or at least not with same intensity. Of course, the politics around it, I cannot help that, but I'm optimistic.
Melanie, I'm curious about the difference between the approach for more urban schools versus rural schools. Stevens Point isn't Madison, it's not Milwaukee, but it's still much larger than, say, Bloomer, where you're working. Mm-hmm. So how do you gain ground on equity for rural schools that are perhaps less diverse than schools in larger, more urban communities? Are there differences in the approach?
I think absolutely. There are and there aren't. I think the approach is similar steps, but maybe with different messaging potentially. So a lot of it is trying to build some connections to the diversity in the world and help people see the diversity in the community that maybe isn't as evident as it would be in a larger community, but is still in existence. So kind of acknowledging that there is still diversity in a small town in Wisconsin, even though it doesn't look the same as it might in Milwaukee or Madison. And I think those conversations, those are critical to have in places like Bloomer. It's important to talk about diversity from a broader lens, so more than race and ethnicity, so that people can feel connected to the work and feel like the work matters to them. I think it also matters that the broader worldview piece, the idea that our kids may not stay in Bloomer forever, they may go somewhere else, and it's very likely that that place may be more diverse, and they'll need to be prepared to operate in settings that don't look like what the settings look like in our small town. So I think those kinds of things are things that most people here can get behind. I mean, even if we don't agree on some big political beliefs or who we might vote for, generally, we can get behind the idea that we want our kids to grow up and be contributing members of society. We want them to be successful and confident and feel connected to the people around them.
We've got about 2 minutes left, and I want to ask Sam, how are you going to evaluate these programs and changes that you're recommending moving forward? How will you measure success in Stevens Point?
For the short term, I think each program, we're trying to measure each activity on its own merit. We do exit survey and look through those. And then long term, we're creating things to measure what we've done. We want to see community engagement. We want to see teachers empowered to build capacity and train trainers who can multiply those of us doing this work. So we can, in the next year and a half, look at where we started and see where we're going. One more thing that I wanted to add from what Melania mentioned before is some of the work we do really benefit every student. I think of it like in those old days when they were advocating to create curb ramps for individuals with disabilities. Today, all of us benefit from those curb ramps. And that's how I see our job, the things that we're doing ends up benefiting every student. It's not It's not to make students feel guilty or feel disempowered. It's actually empowering them, creating them, teaching them about individual spaces and confidence and things like that. It's just the different lenses in which we approach this might not be sit well with others, but the goal is to get our kids happy, excited, safe, and looking forward to coming to school.
In our last 30 seconds, Melania, I just want to ask you, what would you like parents to better understand about the work that you're doing?
I think I would just like them to understand that there's more common ground than they might expect. That if they have questions, they should come and ask. They should call their superintendents. They should talk to the people in their schools and talk to their local school board members and really just get involved and ask questions, I think, in a way that they're staying open to the answer. And that's something that we're trying to do as well as consultants in the field.
You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert, extending a sincere thanks to our guests, Melanie Leverson and Sam Dinga. Our producers are Joy Ratchkramer and Kate Spranger. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Excuse me, Joy is our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program, as well as our previous programs at wpr.org/route51. If you have an idea for a future program, by all means, email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. Next week, we'll be back, but until then, we're headed out of town.